otherwise it's awfully fragmented. And we have an application out to the NSF to support this for a three-year period, but eventually we want the ACS to take it over. And obviously a lot of valuable material correspondence is being discarded. And if we had such a place, I think everybody would be gladly to make a contribution if they know how valuable this becomes. Would you favor the ACS to establish this kind of center? Would this give you some kind of sense of good feelings that you know it is in the right hands?
Well, I can't say that I'm too enthusiastic about a project like this because I don't know. The history of science is a kind of a thing relatively few people are interested in. The large number of people, they say, oh yeah, it's interesting, but they don't spend any time with it.
Well, the nuclear physicists and chemists, nuclear chemists, let's talk about chemists, are doing something like that. The biochemists and molecular biologists operate a center like that, and the rubber chemists. And interestingly, these are the three areas: nuclear chemistry, biochemistry, and rubber, which made tremendous technological advances. The other areas probably have an attitude similar to you, to yours. But why are they interested in? Do they have a greater sense of history, or because they feel that they are doing the pioneering work and they are describing the age in which they live? I don't know.
I guess it's an individual thing. My feeling is that there are not many people who get interested in this. I mean, even in that area, if you take 1,000 rubber chemists, how many of them are going to be interested in the history of...
Well, it's not how many are interested. It's a question of documentation.
Yeah.
Which...
I guess it should be documented, is it right?
And... because we are much too close to the events. We really don't know what went on, whether it's important or not. You know?
You know, interestingly, in terms of rubber chemistry, mm-hmm. and we were talking about teaching at the beginning of classes, everybody talks about cis and trans, olefins, you know? I used to just do it with, say, butene, just showing. In the last couple of years, I changed the approach to... completely, and what a difference it made in the students. I said, well, you know, what do chemists do? This was one of the first three or four lectures in organic. And several years ago, people saw a certain plant that when it was cut and exuded a milky-like liquid, which gave a sort of a rubbery-type substance. In other words, described natural rubber. Chemists were interested in natural products. What'd they do? Well, some people got it and heated it, and they got isoprene out of it. See, that's just a little structure on the board. So they said, well, that means that this substance must be formed of isoprene, since when you heated it, you got this low boiling stuff. I said, and after they knew that, I said, some other chemists said, well, suppose we start with this isoprene, can we get back to rubber? And they tried it, and they got two different results. When some people did it, they got a substance just like natural rubber. When other people did it, they got a hard substance, got a purchase. So they both start with the same substance, and they get two different polymers, I use the term. And I wrote them on the board and showed them that the difference was cis and trans. So the first time I mentioned cis and trans, they tied it up with rubber-like or gutta-percha-like.
You usually end up with it, but you
started
with
it,
which is a good teaching device.
It raises students, attention. You know, they sit on the edge
interest.
Of the seat
yes.
to listen to
yes.
this.
Yes.
My point is that almost everything in chemistry has something you can relate it to that will interest the student who's not necessarily going to be a chemist either. This is an interesting phenomenon.
Coming back to what we were talking about, it I noticed on your desk issue of General Chemical Education, there's an article there by Aaron Ide, the Badger, Badger work or something like that, where he traces the education of every member in the University of Wisconsin department. I don't know whether you I think it's in this issue here. This one here, it's the one either before or after. This is January, February. Well, it sits on my desk. The point is that many departments are quite interested what is the genealogy of the professors. In other words, how did other chemists influence successive generation?
Very little.
On the contrary, very much. And of course,
how
most.
How were you influenced by having worked with Mel Newman?
Tremendously. How? Well, my entire attitude, my philosophy, you cannot avoid it.
Like
this
what?
Is. Like everything, period.
I mean, can't you identify it a little more specifically?
Or my attitude toward laboratory work.
You're out of it now.
Well, I'm out of it, but I think I was rather. Diligent in laboratory. I produced number of students and publication.
And the idea of commitment.
Yes, commitment, and how you address yourself to a graduate student. It's sort of taking over. I was decently treated. I sort of take it for granted that I will treat everybody decently. And I think if you had a SOB for a research director, you probably turn out to be just like him. I mean, there are many things that you can say and point the finger to. It's very important. And most chemists trace the genealogy over to Liebig, just Liebig. I mean, he started out this. And of course, this article too traces everything to Liebig. And if you go to Gießen, there's a Liebig Museum, there's a big chart where every Nobel Prize winner is tracing his genealogy to Liebig. It's either by direct descent or by association with a postdoctoral work or something like that. So whether you realize it or not, you have been influenced by Mel. And you are carrying on certain ideas, and if you never thought of it, but I would be surprised, but you are. I'm sure you are. The point is, you are a product of Anderson. Do you know where Anderson got his training? With whom and how does this trace back? What is the genealogy?
No, he came to this country from
Sweden, you mentioned.
Sweden.
Yeah, do you know?
And he got a job in New Orleans. I really don't know much about it.
I think it would be interesting. No, I just want to see whether we're also tracing our genealogy.
It's a generalization. Point is that if a person can have he doesn't have to have. That's the point I'm making. Well, he can have. But just by virtue of the fact that you have a certain genealogy, doesn't the chemical genealogy especially, because there isn't any genes transmitted, so that's eliminated. The point is, it can have. The question is, if it does have, then that's the important thing. If he does, he always can have. I think it would be interesting to explore, actually, in terms of the influence that Mel has had, aside from reading papers and getting ideas, which opens up a whole new area. What influence has he had on individuals who have contributed to chemistry?
Well, if you talk about influence, though, you take your parents, which really have more influence than anything. And one of the things I've always told my kids and anybody who is listening, I think parents try too often to influence their children whereas they shouldn't. In other words, why should my father have told me he wants me to go into business with him? I'd have probably had a better chance of going with him if he hadn't tried to do it. I think I've always told my kids, I said, don't think because I'm a university professor, you even have to go to college. I said, whether you go to college or get a college university, it's entirely up to you. I said, it won't make me happy or it won't make me sad. The only thing I would more or less insist on is that whatever you do, you try to do it to the best of your ability, whatever it is. And I would say that that philosophy would be better. But well, how many children have you seen almost ruined by their parents trying to
insistence,
force them
sure,
to do
true.
This or do that mm-hmm. when they don't want to do this or do that?
But here we are talking about
these animosities
to adults, to students who have voluntarily come to you, and they obviously were influenced. And it's this kind of a genealogy I'm tracing. What was your influence on students?
Well,
how were you influenced by your
teachers?
I'm trying
to say the same thing, yeah. At least as long as I can remember that whatever they do, they try to do it as well as they can. And what field they work in. Mm-hmm. I've had students come to me and say, Doc, what should I do? Should I go into teaching or industry or what kind of industry? Yeah. And I'll say, look, I said, I can't give you advice. I don't believe there's such a thing as just one field for any person that he can be happy in. There are any number of things you could do and be happy. Being happy is a personal attribute that comes from, I think, working hard at something to be good enough at it to give yourself self-satisfaction.
You always had a reputation as an excellent man in the laboratory, so far as technique is concerned, among other ones. Do you recall any student who was not properly influenced by your insistence on good laboratory technique and material balance and everything that went with you?
Well, I'd have to look over the list, but certainly yeah. there were some students that I never thought too much of when yeah. they got finished, but I would say what I had to say up to a certain point, and then I just wouldn't belabor the point anymore. If they weren't doing it, well, all right, they weren't doing it.
But as you know, you have some colleagues where students are usually or customarily sloppy, mm-hmm. because the man who they work for obviously does not point out the deficiency, and they were have sort of
well,
lax.
Now, sloppiness and results are different things.
Well,
one of the most productive students I ever had was also one of the sloppiest ones.
Oh.
I call him Harold Carnes. He works at Upjohn.
C-A-R-N-E-S. Yes.
And you'd go and just look at his list. There's stuff all over the place, you know. It looked like a madhouse. He got more stuff done, and it was well done. Boy, when he got his final compounds, there they were in high yields, beautifully pure things. But if you look at his lab, it was horrible. Then another guy was a fellow named George, an Indian. He came here as a postdoc from Gilman. He was the neatest person I ever saw. That lab desk, you know, you could eat food off of it. And he also was highly productive. Now, here are two extremes.
Yes.
So I think it's an individual.
Yes. But to pursue this in a different light, you would think, John, if that genealogy that over the years with so many students that Mel has had of different kinds, that there would be identifiable kinds of characteristics. For example, you compare you and me, we're sitting here. What common thing do you think we have as a result of having experience of training with Mel?
Well, I think many of them. I think if we put our attributes and on a line, make a ledger of it, we're going to just name your own, you see, what you think. So I think we would have a pretty good one-to-one correspondence.
Well, I'm not sure of that, but I'll tell you one thing that, because there's no way to test it,
yes.
but there is one attribute that has been tested over the time, and that is the kind of affection and esteem. That is certainly the one characteristic of the students that have worked with Mel, demonstrated repeatedly by all kinds of attributes that are clear. So I think that is clearly one identifiable objective thing.
I'm quite sure we would have found it on our list, too.
I think when I look at what special kinds of things that I got out of my course. That's a very individual thing. It depends where you are in the stage of your life, how open you are to influences, what your own family background has been. After all, a teacher still in many ways a model to many students. We all have had our experiences in the teaching field, and we may not like it, whether we like it or not. In fact, we are models for many students. They're in a stage of their life when they are probably rebelling against their own family background, looking for new kinds of surrogate and so forth. And I think that this is a very important aspect of teaching, whether we recognize it or not. And at least in my administrative career, which was relatively short-lived, one of the things I always felt was important to have certain kinds of people, even independent of the basic contributions they can make to the science, as individuals, as people, with certain qualities that I would hope were copied by students. Well, aside from that personal thing, I would say one of the great things that Mel taught was a love for manipulative skill and the pleasure that one could get out of manipulative skill in a laboratory as an end. That is just the beauty of being able to handle things well and come out with something that looked good. And it was a certain beauty about chemistry that you can read all you want to, but you could never
it hasn't been a problem.
Oral history with Professor Newman, Ohio State University, on March the 3rd, 1979. This interview is conducted by Professor Milt Orchin, University of Cincinnati, Professor Waters, the speaker, Southern Illinois University. This is a real three-side two.
I don't know. What would you say? Am I right?
That much?
I don't know.
You're presently looking at a medal. May I see this particular medal? This is Joseph Sullivan Medal. It is an award to Melvinus Newman. Tell us a little bit about this medal.
It's given every 5 years by Ohio State University, regardless of field, and the person receiving it either has to be teaching there or have had some connection with the university over the years. And I got this in 76, I think it was.
Is it for excellence in research or teaching or both?
Well,
good time.
This gold medal is awarded, and they have a bronze replica. Well, what are you supposed to do with a gold medal? Keep it in a safety deposit box?
So. Yeah,
I think so. What good does it do in a safety deposit box?
That's life these days. Yeah. You have to keep all your valuables in a safety deposit box.
Melt it and sell it for cash.
Well, you know what Bohr has done with his Nobel Prize medal.
Yeah.
When the Nazis came to Denmark, he dissolved it in aqua regia and had it stored all during the occupation, and then he had it recovered and recast.
No, no, really?
That's a true story.
That's true.
So if you don't know what to do with it, you can dissolve it. You know? Regia. How many honors and distinctions have you received over the year?
Some of them over here.
So Newman is looking over his shelf, those various medals and plaques that are displayed. Here he does not know how many. He says his wife is the keeper of it, and now he has to go and count.
Morley medal, Princeton.
section.
What year was it?
1969.
What are the medals for? Are they as a recognition as a researcher or as an educator, a teacher, or what?
Mostly, it doesn't say. Yeah, this is the Sullivan Medal. Teach all that is worth knowing. Founded by Thomas C. Corwin, Mendenhall, 1920.
The fact that you were made a Regents Professor obviously was an honor too. That goes back a number of years. Was there some medal at that time connected with this appointment?
No, the university just decided to have special professors. They've since stopped it, so I don't think they have any more. I think I'm the last one. They're retired.
Did they run out of endowed chairs, or money for endowed chair, or what?
I guess so. American Columbus Section Award. That actually was the first Columbus Section Award. That was 2 years ago.
Well, I remember I came here for that. That was down at the Ashland Oil Company Research Center.
I won the Columbus Pro-Am.
In other words, you treasure your golf medal more than... Well, I must tell you that in my own office, when you come, you don't see a diploma of PhD, but you will see a gold plaque of being a life master in bridge. This I display.
Fair enough.
But nothing else. So I'm fully in sympathy with you displaying a Pro-Am medal or plaque in golf. And what is this big cup? That's a golf?
That's a golf.
That's
golf.
Also a golf. Was this a local tournament?
Yeah, a local club.
I hope it was filled with champagne when they
air.
Gave it to you.
Filled with air.
With air. That's not fair. I see a citation, American Chemical Society, Melvin and Newman.
Award for creative work in synthetic organic chemistry, 1961.
Well, I think that probably is the biggest honor that an organic chemist can get, isn't it? Short of getting the Priestley Medal, which is for chemistry in general, but in the field of organic chemistry. Isn't this true?
Well, and the Roger Adams Award, I think Mel's got from them both.
Yes. Roger Adams is a more recent...
It's true. I don't have it yet. It's just been awarded.
I know anything about it, so you have been selected to be the medalist?
Yeah. This June at the Organic Chemistry Symposium in Tucson.
How many times has this been given now? Two or three times, isn't it? Because it's rather recent.
I think it's 11 in all.
11?
I have a little booklet on it here someplace. But
well, wasn't this done in memory of Roger Adams? And he really died only recently.
It's given every other year.
Okay.
And it's...
I think Bartlett had it last year. Isn't it? So,
I don't know.
And,
I'm not sure. I think.
Well, I'm sorry that I will not.
Corey.
The Korean.
Barton got the first one, and Wittig and Whiskin, as far as foreigners go, and someone else, and then Corey, I think, got it, and Woodward.
Roger Adams? Maybe I'm wrong. I'm speaking on top of my head. I thought this was given in memory of Roger Adams.
It was, but I think it was started before he died.
Was?
I think Barton was the first recipient, and Woodward was the second, and then...
There are usually citations that go with receiving an honor, an award, or a medal. Do you recall the wording in those citations? What a committee like that considers your most valuable contribution?
No, it hasn't been awarded yet, see.
Well, how about the one of the division of organic chemistry. What does it? That's 1963. What does this say?
It doesn't say anything.
On the citation, yes.
In recognition of his outstanding contributions to chemistry in particular, for his brilliant syntheses of a series of unusual polycyclic hydrocarbons, thereby demonstrating optical activity in overcrowded molecules. And that was presented at St. Louis. In
61. Well, obviously the committee in 1961 reviewed your work up to that point, and I think it summarizes well your principal activity. This is now 15 years old or more. Would you add anything to this kind of a citation? What other field of chemistry would you add to it now?
Well, I don't know. I'm maybe unique, but I personally, I think all awards should be abolished.
Oh.
The personal satisfaction of doing good work is enough for me, and the fact that other people come around and pass a medal and have a dinner is really of almost no consequence. My family likes it, yeah. But I can't say that I...
Well, aren't you unduly modest?
I don't call it modesty. It's a question of personal. Some people like things and some people don't. Mm. The less attention paid to me for an achievement is one thing. If somebody says, gee, you know, that was a nice reaction you did, that's enough for me. You don't have to put a medal out for it or anything. The everyday use of whatever you do is plenty of reward.
Well, but still, it is certainly ego-flattering that other people recognize your contribution and certainly would like to go on record.
The word I would like to use is embarrassing.
It's embarrassing? Well, I still think you're unduly modest. Being a university professor for so many years, and an organic chemist in particular, you produce compounds, you also produce people. We talked about compounds. What, in your opinion, was the greatest and most satisfying products of I as turning out a chemist, a good chemist and a good human being?
Well, each person is an individual, and trying to compare two different people, I think, is like an unduplicatable experiment.
Well, I understand that, but which you found the greatest satisfaction? In other words, you mentioned the fact that right now you're more interested in those difluorination, you know, it challenges, mm-hmm. you know, something very unexpected and obviously satisfying. You must have had similar reaction dealing with people.
Well, if I have, I haven't thought about it.
Well...
Each person is, it's an individual, and it's like two different things all over. In other words, I don't try to compare, gee, do I like being with him more than I like being with him, or do I admire him more than I admire him? I just don't think that way.
Well, how about the chemistry contribution of some of your students? They certainly must bring out some kind of a reaction, especially satisfaction. And say, gee, that is nice work, and I'm very happy he was one of my students. Do you recall work that Harry Walborski, for example, has been doing with cyclopropane? Is this something that you find great satisfaction? I mean, I'm using it sickly as an example.
I can't say this is something that I get my most satisfaction. I don't think that way. If I see a nice piece of work, I think it's great no matter who did it. And if I have any influence on any people, well, it's fine, but I don't think about it.
Mm-hmm. I'm surprised, really. I don't know, Milt, how do you feel? Don't you find any particular pleasure of noticing that some of your former students are doing well or making a mark?
Well, I suppose it's always true. Mel says he hasn't thought about it, and I really believe what he says.
Yeah,
because
sure,
if there's any person I've met over my lifetime who says what he really thinks,
that's right.
Mel is the person. And not whatever he says is really true, because he may not have thought it through, but it's his honest It's an honest answer.
At the time.
Yes, yeah. Sure. But I think that in the sense that, as I was trying to generate before, that there is a certain, in the relationship of many students to their major advisor, there is an element of a child-parent relationship. And to some extent, then, I think that that attitude is fostered on the surrogate parent. And like all parents, you can't help but feel proud when one of your children, real or not, I mean, it's expressed in the genealogy stuff, does well. It's natural, but I think that that's probably true. That I don't know whether, for example, me personally, whether Mel has followed my work, let's say I've done in the last 25 years or so, I would think probably not, and I wouldn't expect him to. On the other hand, I think if I were to receive some kind of recognition, I would hope that he would feel some kind of tinge of pride, not only because
well,
it was
I
good
feel
friend, but
pleasure, but pride is the wrong adjective with me. I don't truthfully say I feel proud about anything. I can't think of anything I've ever done where pride... In me, there is no such thing as pride. Might sound strange, but... I don't mean I don't enjoy things and appreciate things, but I don't know. Maybe I don't know what proud means.
Well, maybe it's we're getting too a little bit. Not that it isn't important, but you have to probably define, you know, your reaction of what you mean by pride. Well, I would express it as pride. It would be a spin-off on if I. I'll give you an example which is irrelevant to anything we say, but which, say, the way I would feel pride. The woman who works for us at our home came in one morning when I happened to still be at home, black woman, and her jaw was just swollen up. I says, "My God, what happened to you?" She says, "Well, I got an infected tooth." I said, "Well, what are you doing about it?" She says, "Well, I'm taking medicine for it." The point is, she couldn't afford to go to a dentist. Well, my son is a dentist, so I called him up right away. I said, "Mort, you know, Sally's here. She looks terrible. She's got a swollen jaw. I'm going to take her out to you." Mm-hmm. So I took her out to him and waited while he extracted the tooth. And he did it very well. She came back, and she was fine, and she was so happy. Well, I felt that I'd invested all this money in this kid's education. I felt proud that he could relieve someone's pain and was willing to do it, didn't charge or anything. Now, that's I feel proud he was able to help somebody, and I had some minor thing in helping with it. You feel good, but I would feel proud. So, yeah. So it's just the way you use the word. It's something that was helped somebody. I had a minor role in it, so I guess I...
Well, you had a big role. That's what I said.
There is a person who does it. You know, you just hope that you're talking about how you're going to influence your children, real or in a sense, since I have adopted children, I'm always a little careful about talking about children and separating the biological from the influence. Now, so I'm more sensitive, I think, in that way to influence that people have who aren't the real parent. And we were talking about the influence, you and I both admit in different ways, that Mel had a tremendous influence on us. I think you can't help feeling, well, if I instill a certain set of values that are my own values on this person, I feel, my expression is, I feel proud that I was able to make my influence felt, and I feel, well, it's lifted the level, someone's made happier, or something had some kind of influence.
Well, I'll feel happy that so and so did such and such a thing. Happiness and pride, I guess it's just a question of definition. Pride has something to do with, I think I'm better because of a certain thing. And I don't relate it to me, I relate it to the other person.
Well, I'm sure that you received letters expressing congratulations, of your award or recognition. Mm-hmm. Have you ever written a letter like that to any of your teachers or students?
Yeah.
Yeah. So obviously you must have been a proud.
You can't use the word with, you know, without an expression of what you mean by it.
An acknowledgement, obviously, an indebtedness, moral indebtedness, to be sure, and a pat on the back, glad that you got it, and obviously coming from you and being associate or something like that, it must have been very much appreciated.
You know, when we were talking about the kinds of skills and attitudes and values that we learned by working with Mel, and I mentioned this joy, aesthetic pleasure that was communicated, you know, and having done something well and gotten some result. Well, another and more practical attitude, I think, that I appreciated at that time was the judgment on how much effort one should spend on doing something. And so you look at what you want to do and you say, now, do I need to spend a lot of time doing this carefully? I remember watching Mel, since I had the unique experience of being the only student who actually worked in his laboratory. And I would see him, for example, take a mixed melting point that just... Well, now, a mixed melting point is very good to get very intimate mixing, see? So I would see, you know, grinding away in the agate mortar, making sure it was well mixed. At other times, it's not important to spend all that time mixing it. And this is a trivial example, but it's very important. Don't do anything more than you have to do, but when you have to do it, make sure you do it well. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a thing in life. And engineers really have models for that. And how you're talking about, well, you get, it's a question of effort versus, you know, what you
I recall you were telling about John Shifkin, who went on a tangent for a year or so, you know. Was this typical of you, giving so much rein to a student who wanted to pursue what looked like a dead end, but you couldn't really deny him that opportunity to prove it himself?
He wanted to make the study, the change of a pseudoester, the rate of hydrolysis and methanolysis. And he was going to make it of benzoyl benzoic acid, the elemental ester. Mm-hmm. And talking with him, I said, now you should get two compounds because you're forming a new asymmetric center. And so he worked with it a while, and he got one diastereo ouse pure. And the other one he couldn't get. And I'd say, well, it's all right for the purpose we want it. We don't need both. One is perfectly okay. We just want to get an idea of where the rate is. And no, he says, I want to get the other one. And I said, well, I said, how much time do you want to spend doing it? He says, I want to get it. I said, well, I think you're making a mistake in judgment, but I'm not going to forbid you to do it. So he spent, wasn't a year, but I think it was several months before he finally gave up on it. And when he finally wrote his thesis and got everything finished, he berated me for not denying him. He says, why did you let me waste so much time? Well,
looking back, Shifkin was one of the
and
early
he was
students.
Smart. They call him the brain, yeah. See?
Did you change your attitude since that time?
No, it didn't bother me at all.
I know, but did it influence you, the fact that a student berates you in retrospect? I'm quite sure it was a friendly berate. I know, John, that's our opinion of you.
It's kind of a thing that comes up all the time. I have talked with many students, and I said, look, you write down, usually, an approach to a problem. Now, any chemist knows that if you think about it, you can write down more than one approach. I said, what you normally do is you write as many approaches as you can think of. And then you have to evaluate the approaches. Which one am I going to try first? Because you have to do something. And I said, you're very fortunate indeed if the first thing you choose turns out to be the best. I think the odds are against it. And as a matter of fact, I talked about this with Woodward years later. I said, you're one of the world's greatest synthetic chemists, and when you want to make a compound, you think of every way you can, don't you, before you start? And he said, yeah, that's right. He says, I think many things as I possibly can.
All right, this is
it. Go ahead. You choose what you think has the best chance of working. Mm-hmm. He says, yes. I asked him, did you ever have the first thing you tried work? He says, never, without any hesitation.
Mm-hmm. I have done the same thing as you have taught me. I always ask my students to outline various options and started work that way. Have you been practicing this particular aspect of your education with your student?
I don't think I talked about it at that time. I was just beginning.
All right. This is what I try to nail down. Is this something that experience have taught you to suggest to student, or you made it a practice? Or is this something that Anderson may have used, or some associate, say Fizos, anybody like that, that you associate prior to being on your own?
As I don't recall anybody ever saying that to me.
Okay.
It came as a result of my own experience.
But I'm quite sure this, as long as we're talking about influence, I have been doing, I'm most likely other students have done it as well, but I have many colleagues who were started student right exactly where a former one left off. No chances, here it is, you continue the work.
Well,
and the challenge is gone,
right,
in many respects.
And the thing that disturbs me a lot about, let's say, modern day professors at universities is, you may have noticed this, you'll see an article by a star, you know, one professor, six names associated with it, and you can tell from the nature of the work that they were all graduate students or all postdocs, some are both, in the same paper. Now, I think this is done because the guy wants to get his results out quickly. He's not thinking of the education of the people involved. He's thinking about how quickly he can get his results out. Now, if you have six people working on something, you have to organize it, don't you? You say, you do this, you do that, you do this. You can't leave it to six people to work independently. And I think this is a mistake in chemical education, because they're being more or less told what to do. Whereas, to me, it seems like the best education is to, here's a problem. Now, you think about it, talk about it with me as much as you want, but you're going to have to make a decision as to what you're going to do. I'm not going to come and tell you what to do.
Well, we can rationalize. We all heard about publish or perish. This is doing lab results or perish, because
and
you need
wrong.
It in order
it's
to get funded. It's wrong, obviously.
Because
wrong.
Just think of what the graduate students do. Here, you work on this. Here, you work on this.
Well, this comes with the proliferation of grants, at least. At one time, there was a proliferation of grants. We wish we would be back. But where you had to write progress reports, just like in industry, you had to show to a sponsor that something was done, you know, and you cannot very well describe the blind alleys that students had to investigate to satisfy their own curiosity. You sort of keep a closer track of them and make them stick to the proposal, which is unfortunate.
It's a mistake.
Did you ever had any difficulty having received a grant where the final report was not exactly along the line that you outlined or suggested?
I never had it, because my reports were always very brief. I looked upon these reports as something that somebody has to check off on a name someplace. I doubt if anybody ever read them. But I did in a cancer grant once. I was told that I wasn't going to get the grant. So this was for about two or three postdocs or students. This was maybe 6 or 8 years ago. Zero money all of a sudden. And I rang up the guy and I said, you know, what's the problem here? They said, well, the committee said you didn't have enough publications. And I really hit the ceiling at that.
What year was that?
This was publications on that particular grant.
Oh, I see. Resulting from
total.
The grant. I see.
They
all
didn't
right.
have enough publications on the grant. And I hit the ceiling. I said, in the first place, a lot of this stuff is going to be published in the Journal of Medicinal Chemistry. They won't accept a paper unless you have the test results. And I said, sometimes it takes over 2 years to get the test results. And on this particular thing. I said, I'm waiting on, there will be 3 or 4 papers on it, but I'll wait till I get the results. Well, to make a long story short, I contacted some of the people who were doing the testing and everything, and they wrote letters into the cancer thing, and the grant was finally made. But that just shows you how numbers of publications mm-hmm. can be used, and I think it's a mistake.
Well, this is one of the things that it's not necessarily the granting officers or the policy, because they are being supervised by Committee of Congress, and Proxmire get a hold of it, you know. They do count the number of publications. In other words, was this completely wasted public money, or what has come from it? And they do count just entries. It's a foolish and short-sighted sort of a policy. But it is a chicken and an egg type of a problem. How to eliminate? Where are you going to cut it to break that vicious circle? Because it keeps propagating itself.
Common sense is just leaving government, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The more the federal bureaucracy, as you call it, has control, the worse it's going to get. Mm-hmm.